Support for Faith Matters comes from the law offices of Mullen, Hoard, and Brown, LLP, offering a full range of legal services to regional and national clients. Mullen, Hoard, and Brown are members of ALFA International. More information is available at 765-7491 or mullenhoard.com.
Welcome to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Join us for a conversation about faith in everyday life. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health, celebrating 100 years of faith and healing for Eastern New Mexico and West Texas. Covenant Health's mission continues to be ministry through healing by caring for the whole person, body, mind, and spirit. Now here's your host, Tom McGovern.
I'm Tom McGovern, host of Faith Matters, and it's my delight this Sunday afternoon to have as our guest my longtime friend, Dr. Paul Carlson. Paul is Professor Emeritus of History at Texas Tech University and of late the editor of Caprock Chronicles. Welcome back, Paul, to Faith Matters.
Thank you, Tom. It's a delight to be here.
What's a special bond between you and I is my delight and your expertise in local history and the history of where we find ourselves. Your interest in the history of the plains and the peoples, modern and ancient, who have inhabited the plains, where did you get that from?
I got that from Ernest Wallace, former professor at Texas Tech, who was my mentor. He was the Western historian and the historian for Native American studies. Well, I studied under Ernest Wallace. I came to love this area and its history, and I have written several books, and almost all of them relate to Lubbock and the South Plains.
Paul, as you reflect on this wonderful land where we find ourselves in the sky and the wonder of God's creation that is made visible to us every day, you would trace the inhabitants of the plains, this part of Texas, West Texas, back to the beginnings of the people on the continent.
Lubbock area has been inhabited by humans from about first time that humans came to America. We don't know exactly when they came. Some anthropologists say 15,000 years ago. Some say more than that. The best evidence, I would guess, is about 15,000 years ago, and we know that humans have been in the Lubbock area for almost 12,000 years. So there have been humans here for a long time.
Remind us of the wonderful excavation, not just excavation anymore, just off the loop.
Oh, yeah, Lubbock Lake site has revealed a lot of evidence about human activity in this part of the world, from the Clovis people and the Folsom people and others who followed. Clovis people, because of the points discovered at Clovis, New Mexico. I don't know what their special kind of point. And since it was Clovis, New Mexico, and this point, they were called the Clovis people. And the Folsom, they had little different points, and no question they came after the Clovis folks. Clovis were first, and then the Folsom. Folsom, because of Folsom, New Mexico, where they found a dig site where there were a bunch of bison skeletons and then arrow points, stone points in amongst them. But it was a little different culture. They were much the same. And what happened to Clovis, we don't know. They probably just sort of faded into the Folsom. Folsom faded into others is probably what happened, but anthropologists and others archaeologists need to answer those kind of questions.
As best we can reconstruct, what type of people were they?
Well, they were hunters and gatherers. They hunted now extinct animals like Columbian bison, and I'm not sure all the things they hunted, but mostly herbivores. Yeah. And then, of course, there were saber-toothed cats around and giant armadillos around, and there were other creatures. Longhorn bison were around. They were about two-thirds bigger than modern bison. They were probably the primary food source for Clovis people. During the Folsom period, 9,000 years ago or so, maybe 10,000, those huge bison were disappearing, and they were evolving into the smaller animals that we know today. Of course, the Columbian mammoths were disappearing. Now, why did they disappear is a question that anthropologists and historians and others still argue about. Did they disappear because they were overhunted by these efficient Clovis and Folsom hunters? did they disappear because the climate was changing? And about 10, 12,000 years ago, the glaciers were beginning to retreat. And as they retreated, the immense amount of water in this area dried up. The tall grasses that supported huge animals like mammoths and mastodons, they turned into the short buffalo grasses and other shorter grasses that they couldn't live on. So what caused it? Maybe it was a combination of both, overhunting and a changing climate. Anyway, as the climate changed, the modern sort of climate we have today evolved.
When did the transition from hunters and gatherers to a more dependent on agriculture, did that ever happen?
Yeah, that happened slowly, but that wouldn't happen until almost modern time, after the modern era began, after Christ, after 2,000 years ago. Actually, one could probably argue that it might have started earlier than that, because as animals disappeared, the humans had to rely on gathering more foodstuffs, and then they probably began to plant some of those things they had gathered. It was a slow process that took place over a few thousand years. They became, not on the high plains, they didn't become real intensive farmers, but they were always gatherers and hunters and maybe planting a few plants, and then come around a different season of the year to harvest whatever they planted. They planted something, went off to hunt and gather elsewhere, then came back and perhaps harvested what they had.
Jumping forward several thousand years, eventually became the home to the Comanches and the Apaches, and to we would describe as the Native American peoples.
Yeah. Apaches came in from the north, I don't know, 1300, 1400, 1450, somewhere in there. Apaches came rolling in on eastern and western sides of the Rockies, on the west slope and eastern slope. And some of those Apaches on the eastern slope, they came here in Lee Pons, Mescalero Apaches. Those that came down on the western slope of the Rockies, they became Jicarilla Apaches and other Apaches of Arizona. Comanches then would ultimately push them aside. However, Spaniards were here before the Comanches. Comanches, in that sense, are relatively recent. Coronado, the one we always look to as number one, he's in 1541 coming here. But there were other Spaniards who came through this country. They didn't settle here, but they came through in the 1600s, 17th century. Not until 1700 did Comanches show up in some of those Spanish villages like Taos. In 1706, the Comanches came after the Spanish were here. But then sometime in the 1700s, Comanches came onto the plains. And when they entered the plains, their whole culture shifted. They were dominated by women who were the gardeners. And whoever controlled the source of food, you know, pretty dominated society. Well, when they got toward the plains, men who hunted, they came to dominate society. Eventually, they weren't planting crops on the plains anymore. The Comanches weren't.
So if you were to describe the Lubbock terrain, what would Lubbock look like in 1700?
Blackwater Draw and Yellowhouse Draws, where they come together in McKenzie Park, they both held water. That's one thing. And it flowed pretty regularly. The plains then would be windswept like they are now. There would be grasses growing like buffalo grass, mesquite grass, and other things. They would be free of mesquite trees. I mean, there were mesquites, but fire burned naturally every 3 to 5 years, and it kept the mesquites out of control. Some of those first soldiers who came here, they dug mesquite roots in places like Yellowhouse Draw, but there were no mesquite trees. There might be some mesquite bushes. There might be some other low trees. They weren't big trees.
Paul, we will take a brief break and we'll return in a few minutes to continue this conversation.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health. Since 1918, Covenant has brought together world-class physicians, nurses, and professionals whose sacred mission is compassionate care for every patient. And is Lubbock's most awarded hospital for high-quality patient care, you know you're in caring hands. For more information and to see our 100 years of medical milestones, visit covenant100.org.
Support for Faith Matters comes from Hospice of Lubbock, serving the 19-county South Plains region since 1986. The staff offers faith-based end-of-life care for both children and adult patients. More information is available at hospiceoflubbock.org.
Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Here again is your host, Tom McGovern.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. Our fascinating guest this Sunday afternoon is Dr. Paul Carlson. And Paul, we have been recalling the history of the Lubbock area. You recall very graphically that it was basically still tall grasses, and then the advent of the mesquite came much later to dominate the terrain.
Yeah, mesquite may have been there all the time, but fire kept it from spreading and growing except underground. Mesquite roots could be dug up, but mesquite trees weren't there like we can see in some of ranches around. No, that didn't exist. It was sun-splashed country, and it was hard to find shade if you're out on the plains. Sometimes you could put a blanket up on these low-lying shrubs and crawl under that for shade, but it was grassland.
On our sister station, Channel 5, there was a fascinating account of the early Spanish expeditions. And they were saying that the grass was so tall that there was a kind of a rope as people moved so they wouldn't get lost. Was that accurate or was that a myth?
I've never heard that story before.
I haven't either, you know. Yeah. So just...
No, I have heard plenty of stories about where the Llano Estacado got its name, Stake Plains, yeah. That Spaniards, the first ones, carried stakes and put them in the ground so they could see where they were going.
Yeah.
I think that's just hocus-pocus myth. They had guides, for goodness sakes. They didn't need to plant stakes in the ground, but the grasses were indeed tall. They came up to a belly of a horse. So when you walked through the grasses, after you had passed, the grass came back, and you looked back, you couldn't see where you were. And some people with the Coronado expedition went off to hunt and got lost, and they couldn't find their way back because there was no trail.
When did the first Texas and the plains begin to be inhabited?
If you want to go beyond the explorers and the bison hunters, the first ones would be coming after 1876, because in 1876, the legislature created some 50-plus counties in West Texas in the Panhandle, and that allowed then settlers to come out. Plus, there were land laws passed by the state of Texas. In the earliest part of Texas and West Texas history, railroads and cattlemen dominated the legislature. But as the population of farmers increased, farmers got control of the legislature. Well, they didn't get control, but they had a greater influence. And then the legislature began to pass laws that allowed for farmers to enter the Western Plains. Four Section Act was one of them about, 1876, 77, I forget the exact date, but that said a farmer can apply for four sections of land. He could buy that from the state. He could buy it from the railroads. That allowed settlers to come in. After the turn of the century, about 1906, there was an important legal case in which a farmer settler sued the state so that he could get land, because what cattlemen were doing, like C.C. Slaughter, one of our biggest ones out here, they were leasing that land, and before the lease was up, they would release it. So farmers didn't have a chance. Well, a fellow named Rogan down in Linn County, he sued the state and Slaughter about that, saying that land has to be opened up for sale before it's released to the cattlemen. And that allowed all kinds of farmers to come in. So say about 1906 and afterwards, this place then was really settled up. Think a few years ago, 2009, when we celebrated our centennial, a lot of towns in the Panhandle South Plains celebrated their centennial around the same time.
Farmers, more than ranchers, shall we say, beginning of agriculture, would you say, began around much?
Yeah, well, if agriculture's cattle raising, that came 1876 and afterwards. There were farmers here earlier before 1900, but as a big farming operation, it would come after 1900.
When did the advent of irrigation, when we began to discover the water underneath and to bring it up into irrigated farming?
Some of the ranchers, like the XIT, they realized there was water down there somehow. They drilled wells and put up windmills, like the biggest one in America, perhaps, maybe the world, out at southwest of Littlefield. Casa Samarias, the Yellow House Ranch. They had it, put it up high enough to get above the cap rock and then still higher, you know, to catch the wind. It was the highest in the world. They built that in the 1890s, and it came down in a windstorm, sandstorm in 1926. And of course, they didn't rebuild it because XIT had sold it to Littlefield, and Littlefield would sell it to others and so on. Cattlemen knew there was water underneath, but could they justify the cost of drilling a well and putting up a windmill? After 1900, farmers saw that there was a chance to start drilling these wells, but big irrigation didn't start until the 1950s. Now, there was irrigation before that. It began probably in the 30s with the Depression.
As water dwindles, what's our future going to be if you want to play profit?
Yeah, I don't know about the future, but we're going to go back to dry land farming for sure in terms of cotton. And if I'm not mistaken, and I often am, but I think south of Lubbock, there's more and more they're turning to dry land farming because it's so expensive to put in those deep wells, or there's no water any longer. And I suspect it's going to keep going that way. We'll have to turn to crops that are less dependent on water. We shouldn't be raising corn in this area. We shouldn't be raising corn in the sand hills of Nebraska, for goodness sakes. Yeah. But we are because there's water from the Ogallala. That's a whole nother deal. Think about this. Up north, the Ogallala is still being filled by water from the Rockies. You know, the underground water keeps the Ogallala pretty stable. I imagine it's going down, but it's stable. Here, a million years ago, the Pecos River began to cut its way north. And when it cut its way up north to Cimarron or that area, it denied water coming out of the Rockies into the Ogallala. So we're being depleted here.
Because of natural consequences of the evolution of the river, yeah. Well, Paul, we'll take a short break and then we'll continue this fascinating story.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health. Since 1918, Covenant has brought together world-class physicians, nurses, and professionals whose sacred mission is compassionate care for every patient. And as Lubbock's most awarded hospital for high-quality patient care, you know you're in caring hands. For more information and to see our 100 years of medical milestones, visit covenant100.org.
Support for Faith Matters comes from Hospice of Lubbock, serving the 19-county South Plains region since 1986. The staff offers faith-based end-of-life care for both children and adult patients. More information is available at hospiceoflubbock.org.
Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Here again is your host, Tom McGovern.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. It's my delight this Sunday afternoon to have as our special guest my longtime friend, Dr. Paul Carlson. Paul, we have been wandering all over the plains in terms of its beautiful, varied, colorful history and more or less arrived in the modern era and with the water and the magnificent cotton that gives life and well-being to all of us in this part of the world. But Paul, every area has its stories, its myths. You are editor of a delightful series, The Caprock Chronicles, in the Sunday AJ. And tell us the story of the myth and the story of the white stallion.
A fellow named Daniel Richardson ought to be credited for writing that piece in the Caprock Chronicles, but he based it on a fellow named Frank Collinson. Frank was an Englishman, came to America, became a bison hunter, and then a wolf hunter, and then a cowboy, and then a writer. And he wrote the story of this ghost horse of the Yanomami Staccato. The ghost horse was a white stallion, pure white, and he roamed the area in the Littlefield region around Casa Samarias and north from there. Several people had tried to catch the ghost horse, but were unsuccessful. Well, Frank Collinson ran into a couple of his buddies from New Mexico, and they decided they would try to run down the ghost horse. That was a way to capture wild horses and just keep them running until they were exhausted. So they rounded up about seven people, seven young men, and they kept that ghost horse running. Now, the ghost horse had a herd of several mares. Days passed, and they kept running that ghost horse, and the mares dropped out, but they were after him. And in the end, the ghost horse would not be captured, and he ran to the Casa Samarias with its steep walls like the Caprock, and he jumped over the bluff into Yellow Lake or Illusion Lake into the boggy ground there and died.
There are many, many stories, Paul, that you have recounted in many, many places, but what particular themes dominate in the cowboy lore?
Cowboy is the iconic figure of West Texas, and indeed perhaps the United States. You know, after World War II, the G.I. soldier, G.I. myth was big, and G.I. dolls sold, and we've had others over the years. Somehow the cowboy myth has lasted, hasn't it?
Yeah.
The cowboy in the open range sense has long been gone, and cowboy in the sense of driving animals to markets in Dodge City and Abilene, that's long been gone, but the cowboy myth stays on in Marlboro advertisements, for example.
Is there a poignancy or a certain sadness in a lot of the stories and the songs, do you think?
Oh, yes. Yeah, there is. Well, country western music, it's sort of sad songs, aren't they? The classical ones. I don't know about modern ones.
Tom Mix and Gene Autry, Roy Rogers. To what degree are they representative of the Wild West of the West Texas that you are familiar with?
Yeah. Well, the cowboy's a man on horseback through generations and centuries. Man on horseback has been special. And he's associated with a certain freedom. You know, and these are morals and values that we hold dear in America. So I think that's in part why the cowboy myth continues. When I was teaching at Tech, several times I'd have these young cowboy wannabes in my class with their big hats and their long raincoats. What were they called? I forget. Yellow, and they hang down low, and heck, they've even had cowboy boots. Well, we still wear boots of the cowboy, don't we?
Yeah.
And yeah, we can go to the cowboy clothing store and get all those clothes we want. Every year before the cowboy Christmas ball in Anson, Texas, I better buy me a cowboy shirt and a little scarf so I can go over there.
Do you still go to the dance?
Yes, I still go. I don't dance anymore.
To those who weren't privy to your previous program or read your book, tell us a little again about the Christmas ball.
In 1882, 1885, depending on who you read, a local townsman wanted to promote his hotel. So he encouraged local ranchers and farmers to come to a dance at his hotel. And that dance was held every Christmas Eve, approximately, for about 7 years. And then the hotel burned. It was a popular event. It attracted people on horseback from 80 miles away. They came, more men than women. And so sometimes men had to put on a little red ribbon and indicate that they would dance the female part. It was revived from time to time. And then in the 1930s, a couple school teachers at Anson, Texas. Anson is in Jones County near Hamlin. Hamlin's in Jones County as well, mainly north, but northwest of Abilene. Now the dance is held every year. It was revived in the 1930s by these two gals. When they were thinking about reviving it, the city council outlawed dancing in the city of Anson. So they said it wasn't going to be a dance, it was going to be a reenactment of the dance that had been held in 1880s, and it was. And then they had the reenactment again and again. Finally, they got a special dispensation from the city council to hold it as a dance. It enjoyed great success during World War II when soldiers coming out of Abilene and on the trains would stop off and go to the dance. Then it ran into some tough times, and the sponsors of it struggled a little bit, and then they got Michael Martin Murphy to come to the dance.
Of course.
And he's been coming every year for about 21 or 22 years. It's always the first weekend before Christmas, or the last weekend before Christmas, however you say that. And so it's a different date each year. But it's held for 3 days, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. If you want to go, just go. Michael Martin Murphy's only there one night of the three, so you'd have to find out when he'll be there.
As we conclude, if you were to give voice and expression to the wonder of this part of God's creation, how would it strike you?
I like this region because of the generally dry weather, the generally moderate temperatures. My home is in Ransom Canyon. I just love to sit there on my back porch, look out over the lake. I can see the Caprock Escarpment across the lake. I feel like I'm in the mountains. In fact, Spaniards had a word for the area as the, I don't remember the exact word, but it meant in the translation, something like upside down mountains. Okay. The big blue sky. This is a bowl of blue sky, as one of those flatlanders said. It's a dome of blue sky, isn't it? My wife always used to say that to find beauty around here, you have to look to the sky. The sunsets are so glorious. The blue skies are wonderful. In fact, she and I were taking some pictures a few months ago for the Caprock Chronicles when I wanted the blue sky. And she put that camera up there and took a blue sky, and it is just a magnificent, nothing but great blue sky.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with your host, Tom McGovern. Support for Faith Matters comes from Covenant Health, celebrating 100 years of working to improve the health and quality of life in the communities we serve. Join us next Sunday for another edition of Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1, a service of Texas Tech Public Media.